Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill.
And we're delighted to be with you today.
I'm enunciating here.
You are enunciating.
Some days I don't enunciate so good, and I'm working on it.
Yeah. Have you ever talked to him on the telephone? Sometimes you can't understand a thing he's saying.
Well, I know what I'm saying.
That's all that's important.
What's wrong with this picture?
I think it's because when you call me on the telephone, you're really tired, so
and
it compounds it.
30 seconds on the phone, I'm ready to get off.
Yeah. I don't like to talk on the phone either. Yeah. But I do like talking on the radio.
I do, too. I love this show.
So here we are. And today, we have two interesting guests, Cole Burrell and Sean McNeil. Cole's going to enlighten us on the great many different varieties of Trillium.
Yeah, among other things. And again, I fall in love with something new once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I was walking around our garden just recently, and there was those Trilliums coming up in my little woodland area.
Mm-hmm.
I said, wow,
they
are fabulous.
I only have two varieties. I didn't really realize that there were as many out there as you know, and that will do well for us than there are.
Yeah, and Cole's been around gardening for a long time. He's one of the bright lights in the garden business, among lecturer books and so forth, and be an excellent explainer
mm-hmm.
of trilliums and other ephemerals, really, in the garden and what you can use this time of year. And
great.
Be
good.
Fun.
And Mr. Sean McNeil in Sonoma County, California. He's been involved in plants in one form or fashion for many years, but 10, 12 years ago, he really got engaged in the art of espalier. We'll find out the story behind the story, but I think he got really interested in fruit trees, and then that sort of turned into espalier. And if you don't know what espalier is, it's when you see trees that have been trained. I mean, almost always it's a fruit tree, isn't it, Bob?
Right.
Trees that have been trained sort of flat against mm-hmm. a wall or as a fence to some sort of design, simple designs to kind of fancy designs, that sort of thing. But it's a time or a space-saving function, to be sure, but I'm sure there's other reasons for espalier.
Oh, yeah, just pure beauty alone. Mm-hmm. It's another subject near and dear to my heart. I like to prune, and I sort of fool around with espalier, but I've mm-hmm. never done it to the level that Sean does it, so I'm anxious to talk to him and get some tips.
Great. All right, so that's coming up. We hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
First, what's going on in the Hill kitchen?
Oh, what?
The Wishy eggs.
So did you do an experiment with my eggs?
And I'm going to take pictures, so folks, hang on. Another couple weeks, they'll be photos on our website, our gardening website of Janine's eggs. But yeah, we had two store-bought eggs
uh-huh.
and two Wishy eggs, and Janet cracked them on the griddle,
uh-huh.
and they were one on top of the other,
uh-huh.
and the difference was unbelievable. The store-bought eggs were kind of runny and kind of heading for the hills and kind of light yellow yolk.
Uh-huh.
The Wishy eggs were bright white yolk.
And they stand up.
And they stand up, and the yolks stand up, and they're kind of orange-yellow.
It's insane.
It was just a treat to eat them.
And they do taste better.
They taste better.
And I'm so delighted that you're a believer.
Well, I've always been a believer because we raised chickens for many,
That's
many
right.
years when I was
mm-hmm.
back in my previous life. Mm-hmm. But I forgot.
Yeah. The side-by-side thing
it's fun.
Tells the tale.
So I'm going to stand by, folks.
Okay.
Once they get a picture in focus.
All right.
The Wishy eggs will be on the website.
I'll bring you some more eggs on Sunday when I come by.
That's what this was leading to, actually.
Okay.
More eggs.
I'll bring more eggs on Sunday.
How about your estate? What's up?
All right. Well, I wanted to update you on my tomato seedlings. And I'll bring those on Sunday, too, when I come out to see you guys. But I was so worried about how my seedlings were going to turn out because they usually kind of get leggy and they don't look very good.
Yeah.
But I started a bunch of tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes from seed this year.
Okay.
In addition to some peppers and some Brussels sprouts and some other things. But Bob, you would be so proud of how stout and healthy my little tomato seedlings are.
You go, girl.
They look really, really good.
What went wrong? What went right here?
Well, I mean, I just followed all the rules pretty closely. So maybe I never followed all the rules before.
So.
But, you know, we potted them up, you know, put the seeds out in the little small cells.
Yeah.
And then once they got several true leaves, I bumped them up into little pots that were a little bit bigger. And then I acclimated them to the outdoors slowly.
Oh, you're a good mom.
And then when it was cold, because you know how our spring, we had really cold temperatures.
Yes.
When it was cold, I would bring them in.
Gosh.
But the stoutness I was particularly aiming for and just kept them in as bright light as I could, you know, on the south side of the house, you know, when they were still inside.
You didn't have grow lights? This is just
mm-mm.
natural light?
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, we live in a passive solar house.
Right.
So as long as I kept turning them.
You got light.
You know, it worked.
Now, can you drop a few names like Mortgage Lifter on me?
Yeah,
here?
I can. I have one called Flame,
okay.
which is also known as Hillbilly.
Yeehaw.
And Flame is a really large tomato that's like red and yellow and orange, hence the name Flame.
Great.
Then I have one called Garden Peach and Stew Peace. And
Stew Peace, how do you spell
that? S-T-U-P-I-C-E.
Okay. I thought it was two words.
And Lillipop. And those were heirloom seeds that one of my students gave me.
Oh.
Because she and her mother passed away.
Oh.
Had always done
That's neat.
Seeds, well, yeah. And she had taken it over from her mother, and she had passed them on to me. And then, let's see, and then I have one more. Arkansas Traveler. Another really big one.
What a collection.
Yeah. So.
What great names.
Yeah. So I'll bring you some as well, and you can share in the bounty of my hard seed starting labors.
And I can have maters and eggs for breakfast.
You can. That's a good combination,
I know,
too.
Yeah, it is.
It is. It is. All right, calendar. We have one last reminder. June 1st is the deadline, Bob, for the Garden Tour Passport, where you can get, for $25, it's a $32 value. You can get entry into the Crescent Hill Garden Tour, the Audubon Park Garden Tour, and the Old Louisville Hidden Treasures Garden Tour. But they're going to stop selling these passports June 1st. You can find the passports at Button Seed,
Economy.
That would be Economy Aquatic Gardens, the Plant Kingdom, St. Matthew's Feed and Seed, Thieneman's Herbs and Perennials, and Wallach Nursery. So get your passport soon. Deadline's approaching.
One of those gardens will have some espalier.
I bet you they will,
somewhere,
too. Especially some of those small ones.
Small ones.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Which is a good use for espalier.
Yeah, and I bet you some of them will also have some fabulous woodland gardens, too. In the Old Louisville, lots of big trees.
Yeah.
So lots of shade, perfect situation for the dainty but tough trillium.
And we've got the perfect guest to describe trilliums. He'd be Cole Burrell. He writes books on gardening, gives lectures on gardening, and designs gardens from his home in Virginia. He's a self-admitted certified chlorophyll addict, specializing in blending nature and culture in artistic design. That sounds neat. Just happens to include trilliums and other woodland plants. Cole, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I was reading your biography as an author and lecturer and so forth, and you also worked at the U.S. National Arboretum and the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and also had a city lot in Minneapolis. So it's kind of fill us in on your background and how you ended up doing this stuff.
Well, I've been a lifelong gardener. I started very young as a bird watcher and gardener, and when I was a fairly young kid, I had eye surgery, and for a long time I couldn't use binoculars, and so birds were really my first love, but since I couldn't see them through binoculars and plants didn't move, kind of jumped ship over to plants and have pretty much stayed the course ever since. I was probably about three at the time.
Wow.
That's making lemonade out of lemons, huh?
Yep.
Certainly is. And we'll talk about all sorts of woodland beauties later on in the show, but let's talk about some trilliums. Kind of give us an overall look at the plant, what it is and what it does.
Well, I think a pretty amazing plant. I think probably most gardeners, certainly, and a lot of non-gardeners that just know a few wildflowers can recognize a trillium because it's got that classic sets of three with three leaves, which are actually bracts on the flowering stem. They're not really true leaves, but we call them leaves. And it's got the three sepals that surround the flower and three petals. And what a lot of people don't realize is there's two very different forms of trilliums, those that are called the pedicellate or stalked or stem trilliums. And they have a flower that's kind of the classic trillium that sits up above the foliage.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a group called the sessile or toad trilliums, and the flower actually sits on the whorl of bracts and has no stalk. So the flower kind of looks upward. So it's very different from the classic great white trillium that most people know.
Mm-hmm.
Does it come with any kind of heritage going back centuries or stories or myths involved with the trillium, do you know?
Well, there are a few different myths around. Some Native American myths, which is hard to tell how young or old they are, they mostly center around the use of the trillium, although I did find something about a beautiful maiden being turned into a trillium, but you never know how old or young those tales are.
Right.
Probably the biggest part of trillium lore is their use both as a food and as a medicine, and that's probably the most consistent read about in the literature, and both Native Americans and early settlers used them for a variety of things. And one of the things about trilliums is they have a lot of common names. And any time a plant has a lot of common names, you realize that it's been important to people for a long time.
Had a lot of common uses.
Birthroot is one of the names that trillium has, generally applied often to the red trillium, Trillium erectum. And that name comes for the fact that the trillium was used in various ways, usually to control blood flow, to aid in childbirth and to stop bleeding. It's also been used for a variety of other things to do with blood, as well as topical things for sores and all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's practically nothing a trillium hasn't been attributed to.
But it's primarily the root that is used. Is that right, Cole?
Yes, it's generally the root.
Okay.
And I've found a lot of interesting stories about people eating the foliage of trilliums, both as kind of just a green, or what they used to call a pot herb, and sometimes as more of a cleansing tonic.
Mm-hmm. I'll stick to wine, I think.
Yeah.
Are there species worldwide, or is it just native to North America?
They're found in North America and in Asia. There are no species in Europe, and the greatest diversity is in North America, and as I mentioned, here in North America, we have the pedicillate and the sessile trilliums, and in Asia, mostly centered in Japan, they only have the pedicillate trillium. There are no sessile trilliums outside of North America. So we get the lion's share.
Mm-hmm. So, Cole, for us in Kentucky and a zone 6-7, a typical sort of woodland garden, how many different species are available for us to use?
Well, available is the real key in your in your question there.
Uh-huh.
Many of the trilliums that are available commercially are still wild collected. There are very few nurseries that are propagating. The number is increasing all the time, and there's a lot of research being done on tissue culture for trilliums, but still the bulk of the plants are collected from the wild, and for some species, that's more of an issue than for others. On some of the really widespread plants, like the large-flowered white trillium, and to a lesser extent, the purple or red trillium, Trillium erectum, there's pretty large populations, and the commercial collecting is certainly it has an impact, but it's not been a major impact. And then there's very uncommon to really rare species that it makes a big difference, and there are actually two federally endangered trillium species. A relict trillium, which gets its name because it's believed to have been a relict of a former time when it was much more widespread and might actually have been an important plant in the evolution of the sessile trilliums. And then there's a little trillium that's not particularly showy for a gardener, but it's called the persistent trillium. And it's only found within a radius of 4 square miles in the head of the Tallulah Gorge down on the Georgia-South Carolina border. So it's extremely rare.
That's amazing. Well, let's talk some about the culture. Is there any hope of anybody growing some of these in a suburban shady lot?
Oh, yeah. They're actually surprisingly easy to grow. And you've got a nice, good, loamy soil with a sweet pH, and many, many species of trilliums love that condition. In fact, there's quite a number of species native within Kentucky, but they're really amazingly easy to grow as long as they have a good, rich, evenly moist woodland soil and good spring sunshine and then protection from hot sun in the summer. And so under deciduous trees is really the ideal place.
Now, are they all ephemerals? Will they all just go away by midsummer, late summer?
Yes, most of them. The very rare trillium is called the persistent trillium. Trillium persistens is probably the exception because it keeps its foliage pretty much up till autumn. But most of the other trilliums will shed their seeds, some as early, depending on where they're from, as June, but into July. And after that, they will definitely go dormant.
Mm-hmm. So, Cole, are they pretty good? If you have them planted in the right kind of spot and they're happy, are they pretty good at colonizing themselves?
They are. Now, pretty good is a relative term. Because if they are pollinated, they produce a fair amount of seed.
Okay.
And the seed is dispersed by ants. So the ants will often carry the seed away right before you, as a propagator, might want to collect it. The ants will cut the fruits off, and take the seeds because they have an attractant that draws the ants in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, the Trillium's way of getting the seed away from the parent where it has a better chance to grow.
Ah, yes.
What a great mental picture, just this herd of ants carrying Trillium seeds on their backs, hauling them off.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And sometimes the seed is bigger than the ant. But that said, they do reseed fairly readily in the garden. It takes a couple of years before you'll really see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the average pedicellate Trillium, like the white, great white Trillium or large flower Trillium, will take 5 to 7 years to bloom from seed.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to have some seeds drop and blooming plants the next year like a columbine might do.
Therein lies part of the problem with cultivation and getting more plants available in the market, though, huh?
Right. And the Cecil Trilliums are a little faster. Generally, 4 to 5 years, some of the common Cecil Trilliums, like the one that's often called Sweet Betsy, Trillium cuneatum, which is a beautiful Cecil Trillium, it blooms pretty quickly from seed by Trillium standards.
Now, where would you suggest that our listeners go to find Trilliums to begin this process?
Well, a great place is at plant sales. If you have a nature center or a native plant society near you, a lot of people will dig Trilliums from their gardens if they have seeded around well and will offer some plants for sale, or at rock garden societies. Master gardener sales, sometimes they show up. So that's a good starting place. And there, like I said, there are a few nurseries that are offering nursery propagated plants. So you can find them at a few nurseries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was an article in American Gardener magazine recently, in fact, that listed some nurseries. People might be referred to that from our website, I think.
Yeah, if they look on American Gardener's website and the article on Trillium, they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
Some people also are selling Trilliums that are rescued, because with so much development everywhere, Trilliums are really under more pressure from land development and lumbering practices than most species are for any kind of large-scale nursery collection.
Hmm.
Because you can wipe out thousands of plants in a short time, and it would take a collector quite a long time to dig as many plants as a bulldozer can destroy in a day.
I guess. Let's talk a little bit about companion plants. What would you plant along with Trilliums to make the woodlands all the better?
Well, I always like to combine them with ferns, and the nice thing with the ferns is that they'll fill the spot when the Trillium goes dormant. But I really tend to mix them with almost anything that does well in shade. For early bloom, I like the European wood anemone, which is a beautiful early blooming plant, and a lot easier to grow than our own native wood anemone, which is a little miffy in cultivation. And phlox species, they're always beautiful with phlox, and foam flower looks great with them, wild geranium. Just about anything that won't crowd them. And I think they're really pretty coming up through ground cover plants like phlox, stolonifera, the creeping phlox. And the stems will come right up through them and bloom companionably, and also through foam flower. So those low creeping plants are good. And then taller plants for accent, like Solomon seals, behind the plants are always good. But you don't want to crowd the Trilliums too much while they're in active growth.
Is there any sense that they're an endangered species now?
Well, as I mentioned, there are a few that are literally endangered. They're listed by the U.S. government as endangered species. There's two of those. And some Trilliums are quite rare. Many of the, especially the Cecil Trilliums, have narrow ranges in the wild, and they're restricted to fairly small areas. But most of those rarer, more uncommon plants are not really in cultivation, because they are restricted and usually native to areas within the mid to deep south. They're not often seen as plants sold by nurseries.
Wow. Well, you've certainly pushed my imagination further down the road on these guys, and I've got a small patch at home, and I'm going to make it larger.
You better appreciate that patch.
Another thing to think about, too, with them in the garden is to pretty much annually give them a nice mulch of chopped leaves, so that it enriches the soil and keeps it cool and moist. And the longer the soil stays moist, the longer your Trillium will stay green. And if the soil dries, the Trillium will go dormant early, and sometimes even before it sets seed, which obviously you don't want, because you want as many new Trilliums coming on as you can get.
Well, Cole, thank you very much. Enjoyed having you on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Cole.
Thank you.
Cole Burrell lectures on gardens and has written several books on gardening, including the Hellebore book, A Comprehensive Guide, and Native Alternatives to Invasive Plants. For more information on Cole, his books, or Trillium, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Sean McNeil and the Art of Espalier. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill sitting in a delicate yet elegant position with my arms espaliered.
Espaliered. Yeah. And he's pretending like he's flat and artistically designed.
And goofy.
And goofy. Yeah. But we are going to learn how to shape trees into wonderful designs. Yeah. The Art of Espalier, it's been around for a very long time. We'll learn a little bit about the history of it for sure. But Sean McNeil is joining us now. He's from Sonoma County, California. Sean has degrees in botany and plant ecology. And over the years, he's worked on farms as a landscaper and with roses. But his efforts for the last 12 years have been focused on fruit and the Art of Espalier. The tangible manifestation of all of this, Bob, is Apple Arts Espalier, which he opened in 1997. Sean, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate this opportunity to tell people about my passion of espaliers.
All right. So when did, because, you know, when we were introducing you, you've been involved in plants in various forms and fashions over the years. But, you know, when did your, or why did your focus shift to fruit trees and espalier?
Well, after I got my degree in botany, I moved to Sonoma County and worked on a farm called Sonoma Antique Apple Nursery, and they propagated about 120 different varieties of apples, 80 different varieties of pears for nursery retail sales.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I learned the diversity of fruits that actually exist beyond the red and yellow apples that I thought was the variety that you could choose from, the potential green.
Too. Right.
Yeah. And so my mind really got expanded at that time. And part of their farming operation also involved a training of espaliered fruit trees. And my first introduction to them were a bunch of trees in pots trained on these trellises to be sold to homeowners mm-hmm. to put into their small, usually city lots. And when I looked at those fruit trees and compared them to the big trees that we had in the ground, I thought it was kind of an odd thing to do until I got to the harvest time. And I realized that the same tree, same variety that we had as a full-grown tree did not produce as good a quality fruit as those on the espaliered trees, you know, constricted their growth in these pots.
Mm-hmm.
So that led me to think, wow, now I get it. Now I see why people are interested in these espaliers. And when they decided to stop doing that part of their farming operation, I saw that as a great opportunity to pick up a new little weekend business.
I see.
And start growing these fruit trees.
So maybe we should define espalier. And after you do you know what the history of the art form is? You know, were there practical purposes? Was it sort of a fanciful sort of thing? You know.
Sure. Well, a definition is really easy. It's any plant trained on a trellis. So you could, you know, many people think, oh, I can't do an espalier, but at the same time they may have a rose growing on a trellis or grapes or something like that. And so it really is that simple. You're just putting a plant on a trellis. So that's kind of a good, easy definition. I think fruit trees on trellises is generally how we think of espaliers, and it's extremely important to think of that as a sort of a separate thing than a rose or a vine or something where you just grab it. But there's actually pruning techniques that you use to create the shapes.
Mm-hmm.
Or some people have actually grafted branches to create the shapes.
Oh, wow.
But historically, it kind of goes back into maybe a little bit of plant genetics, and I'll try to be brief and on this. But generally, when fruit trees first began, they were all grown from seeds. And an apple tree grown from seed is what they call a spitter. means you take a bite and you go, pwah, spit it out.
Excellent.
they were really mostly grown to make hard cider with in the ancient times,
mm-hmm.
until the advent of grafting came along. And when grafting came along, people began to get a delicious tasting apple, and then they had an ability to share that variety with other people. And this usually happened in the more noble circles. And the Duchess of Oldenburg has an apple in her courtyard that tastes good, and they call those dessert apples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All the apples we purchase now are dessert apples, but in the past, it was a rarity to have a dessert apple, one that you could actually eat without processing or cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So once that happened, people began to say, wow, I want to have that variety and that variety. And their orchards began to fill up with all these different varieties, so they started to train them along the walled compounds.
Okay.
And then that expanded into Europe. Now you can go and see a lot of orchards are trained in the espalier designs, not for the look, but more for the fruit per acre.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a lot more fruit per acre by growing espaliered fruit trees than you can by having them as standard.
Hmm.
So the popularity came out really about space. Then designs came, and people were able to identify particular designs and fruit trees that actually bear fruit on what we call fruit spurs,
mm-hmm.
are the most ideal, because where they bear fruit in 1 year on that fruit spur, they'll bear again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
So as you create a shape, those individual areas where the fruit will be are known. But when you have other types of fruit, maybe like stone fruits, plums, peaches, apricots, those produce fruit on second year wood, so you're constantly recreating the shape.
Okay.
So it makes it a little bit more challenging to get the formal shapes out of them, but you can definitely espalier them.
But that's why the apple's so well-suited.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As I travel around the country looking at gardens, it seems like I don't see much espalier. I guess that's the reason we've got space here. Is it still more of a European thing, do you think, than it is an American thing?
Well, I think in America, it's more about a premium of space. So I see them a lot of times in the smaller urban gardens.
Okay.
I do know that there's a lot of people, when they go visit Washington's home in Mount Vernon, they really are struck by the espaliers there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the more heritage gardens have them. It's also the traditional use of separating the kitchen garden from the more formal gardens will usually be ringed in espaliers.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're doing in our own vegetable garden at home, we have espaliered, or we're in the beginning stages of espaliering some fruit trees, some apples and pears along the north side of the garden, because there's an 8-foot tall wildlife fence. So, you know, they're pretty flat for now. We're not so ambitious that we want some fancy design, you know, probably just a general sort of informal fan design. So can you take us through the steps of, you know, properly caring for an espalier, you know, once you have it? I know that Apple Art, you can purchase already trained, but, you know, once you get it home, you can't neglect it. You're going to have to do a little maintenance. So, you know, what are the, take us through the steps in terms of being a successful tree trainer, if you will.
Great. I think probably the most difficult thing that people have with beginning an espalier is when you first start off with your bare root whip, which is a good place to start,
mm-hmm.
you pretty much cut it about 16 to 18 inches above the graft. So here you have this beautiful 4-foot whip that you chop down to a third of its size just to start.
Yeah.
Now, once you get beyond that component, what you're doing there is you're allowing the other buds along that stem to break open and begin to form that the basic tier or the bottom level of your espalier.
Mm-hmm.
You get a much more branched pattern by taking away that central leader and pruning it back. The next thing you're going to want to do is begin training that tree, you're going to have some sort of trellis for the tree to grow on. And initially, that trellis is used to hold the branches down or into the place where you want them. But once they begin bearing fruit, it's going to be to hold the branches up so they don't fall and break.
Mm-hmm.
By taking and having these branches spread out from the central trunk for sometimes 8 feet or so, you really create an opportunity of a lot of weight to be on the end when the fruit is ripe that could force that branch down to break. So it's really important, I think, to have that trellis in place from the beginning that can support the fruit later on. The other thing that I think is really important is people get stuck on pruning in the winter time. When you're doing an espalier, you want to prune in the summer, in growth season. And when you prune then, what you do is you slow down that growth and you promote more fruiting growth. So you can, you're trying to use your pruning technique to dwarf the tree even more so than you have through the rootstock. And that will create a tree that you can handle that won't grow 8-foot branches in 1 year.
Okay.
You want to keep that growth down. And I like to say when it gets about a pencil thick, that's a good time to prune it back to about 3 buds, each branch that's not growing in the direction that you want. So you don't want to prune away all of the branches, otherwise you're just going to dwarf your tree so much that it'll never grow and have branches. But you need to leave little branches on there so that that's where the fruiting spurs can develop.
Now, do you have to work with the roots at all, or do you just keep that the same size all the way through the process?
Well, sometimes an espalier may call for root pruning. And what root pruning is where you're going to dig a little trench around the tree, depending on how far space out, to kind of cut back some of the roots. The only variety I've ever had to do that with are some of the figs that we've grown.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then how long will the process take typically to get a handsome-looking fruit-bearing tree?
It's going to depend on what you grow. Different trees are produce fruit in different times of their life cycle. So, for instance, a fig will produce fruit when it's just a little twig. But maybe some of the apples may take 3 to 5 years before they're ready to bear fruit. The design comes in usually the second year of growth. You'll begin to see the shape more.
Mm-hmm.
And by the third through fifth year, you should expect to have a well-formed espalier.
Huh. Let's talk about the art aspect of this. Does the tree tell you what it wants to do? Do you have a picture in your mind that's going to take 3 to 5 years to fulfill your expectations?
Yeah, so, you know, there's different ways. Now, when I'm doing them in my nursery, I have the luxury of saying, wow, this tree is really coming into this shape. Maybe that's what I'll go for. But a gardener, a home gardener who may say, this is the shape I want, get the tree, and then you're forced with making it do that, you're going to resort to maybe more draconian pruning than I might have to do, because if a tree shows itself to already be in a particular shape after the first year's pruning, then it does make a lot of sense for me to allow it to do that. So oftentimes, different varieties of trees will react differently. And when you prune them, they may respond by growing many branches, or they may just grow a few branches in its stead.
If you set out to grow Montana, a map of Montana in your apple tree, can you do that, or is that impossible?
Oh, let me see. Montana's like a square.
Wow.
Yeah. I have seen at the University of British Columbia, they did letters.
Okay.
I've seen hearts done, and so most definitely your imagination is the limits, really, to what you could do within the size of the tree. So if you wanted to grow a 20-foot espalier, you can, and I have done that, and you just need a taller ladder, and you need to start with a bigger tree.
Now, I've seen a lot recently conifers, like arborvitaes pruned in spirals and spruce done like pom-poms. Is that considered espalier, or is that just considered goofy?
I'm not going to not going to judge somebody else's ideas of an aesthetic.
Yeah, I got goofy at home, is why I asked.
Yeah. If it's grown on a trellis, I would say that would be espalier, and I have seen them grown that way.
So the trellis is the key.
Yeah, but if they're not really bearing fruit, they don't tend to need to be trellised, mm-hmm. because the branches will grow strong enough mm-hmm. to maintain that shape. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes when they're sort of the pom-pom looks, I don't think of them that way. But even if you don't have a trellis, maybe if you're training them in a two-dimensional zone, as opposed to a three-dimensional zone, which I see a lot of junipers done that way. If you did them in a two-dimensional zone, I would say you're doing an espalier.
Okay.
So, Sean, there. When I was looking at the offerings that you all have through Apple Art, there are some pretty serious design elements to some of these espalier. Can you talk about some of the more complicated ones that are offered?
Yeah, and one thing I'm just going to say is there's a lot of language out there that describes the shapes, mm-hmm. and it's not always the same. And so I'll just kind of maybe stick with probably the more traditional shape is just the tiered, and that's where individual branches come out in sort of levels, one on either side, mm-hmm. And it continues on up until the height. The tiered shape, usually you should have about 16 to 18 inches between tiers, which looks really sparse when they're young, but it looks great when they're older, which is your goal when you're training, right. Make them look great when they're older. And that's the traditional shape. Then imagine you took those horizontal branches, and on the ends of them, when it got towards the end of the trellis, the bottom one, you started training upwards. Mm-hmm. And then the second tier up, you trained upwards just inside that one, so you looked like you had nested U's inside mm-hmm. of it. Mm-hmm. That would be called a palmette verrier shape. Some people call that a candelabra, but it's traditionally called a palmette verrier, and it looks complicated, and it's a great design for a narrower space but might have more height mm-hmm. that you could use. And another design that people use that I call the candelabra, that's where you just have one bottom horizontal branch, and from that branch rise up all the uprights.
Oh, okay.
16 inches apart. That would be what I would call a candelabra. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And those three shapes, while they seem difficult, they're rather simple to create. Once you make your initial cut and you start getting the branches and choosing the shape, keeping the branches that fit in your shape and removing the branches that don't. Mm-hmm. And then finally, one that is extremely easy but looks very complicated is the Belgian fence design.
Oh, see, I thought that one looked so hard.
And that one is really simple in that you're just training a Y. You're growing the branch, and then you're going to only allow it to grow as a Y, mm-hmm. and then by growing another tree 3 feet away, mm-hmm. You begin to get the intricate pattern.
Okay, so it's like a crisscross shape, basically like a fence, a living fence,
mm-hmm.
What it looks like, yeah.
Well, Sean, what's the funkiest one you've ever done?
Well, I have done, for a school garden, we did more of the let's see what the tree will do to get the kids interested.
Right. Sure.
And we created a couple of trees that have two tiers on the bottom and then rise up to a big heart shape. Oh. We also have done some persimmon trees, which here they hang their fruit in the fall mm-hmm. with no leaves on them, and they look very, you know, very eerie, that white wood with dark orange on them right around Halloween time.
Yeah. That's something we can definitely do here.
And that was a tree spreading about 15 feet tall and about 20 feet wide, so it was very dramatic on this south-facing wall. And then recently I did one right on the San Francisco Bay, where we planted them, and we couldn't have them over 4 feet tall. And so we pruned them quite vigorously about four times in the summer to keep them low, because right over the top of it is a beautiful view of the bay and of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the exciting and difficult thing about that was that you had these constraints that you didn't want to block, but you wanted to get as much fruit in as possible. And so we put 20 trees on an 80 foot run.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So we keep those very small.
Pretty cool. Well, I'm sold. I think I'm going to have to try a couple more things. Thank you so much, Sean. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Sean McNeil owns Apple Art Espalier in Sonoma County, California, where he transforms the average fruit tree into a living, sculpted, and productive work of art. For more information on Apple Art Espalier and Sean's work, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown 89.3 WFPL.
I can tell you've been hurt by that look on your face, girl. Some guy brought a sad thing to your happy world. You need love, but you're afraid that if you give in, someone else will come along and suck you to your game.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we've got several questions.
We do have a couple of questions. How about if I start with you, Bob?
Sit here ready.
All right. This one's from Jay Cooper. Dear Janine and Bob, I'd like to grow a privacy screen behind our house. One thought is to use the evergreen tree that one sees growing wild along the roads here. I believe you've mentioned this tree on your show and identified it as a cedar tree. Would there be drawbacks to this plan? Does it grow fast? Should I fertilize? And with what? Is it a messy tree, et cetera, et cetera? His other plan is Thuja Green Giant, or Thuja.
Thuja arborvitae might be easier to say.
Yeah. No kidding. Arborvitae Green Giant. He's trying to do all this on a shoestring budget, which is certainly understandable. So wondering if we had any thoughts in terms of these two ideas.
Yeah, one of the ironies of living in this neck of the woods is that there are 70 gazillion cedar trees out there, but very few
in our landscapes.
For sale uh-huh. or even named cultivars. Uh-huh. You know, our mutual friend Mike Heyman has spent some time trying to find some of these. And there ought to be one that works because they obviously are suited to this country. They'll mm-hmm. grow in limestone, they grow in rock, they grow in anything, but they just don't exist. So plan B, I think, is his best bet. I think the arborvitae, a green giant.
Very good. Good plant.
It is indeed. It's a tough plant. It is a fast-growing plant, mm-hmm. yet still pretty hardy. It'll grow a goodness a foot or two a year once mm-hmm. it gets cranked up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can buy the smaller ones at a reasonable price.
And you're probably honestly better off buying the smaller ones
yeah.
in terms of better establishment, root establishment,
yep.
if you have to water them, because that's the thing. Since they're an evergreen, you need to be mindful of getting them established, so well-watered when you first put them in. If it's dry in the wintertime, they need to be well-watered as well.
So they get established
yeah.
for sure. The tricky part is he's going to want to put these about 4 feet apart, and
mm-hmm.
that's so hard to do when they're only a foot tall,
mm-hmm.
to make yourself
right.
do that. So think down the road of what they're going to be when they're big guys.
Right.
And give them that space now,
mm-hmm.
and you'll not regret it.
Yeah. And they shouldn't, if your soil's relatively decent, they shouldn't need excessive amounts of fertilizer. But early spring, you can apply some fertilizer to evergreens as they're putting on that new growth.
Yeah.
They'll use it more effectively then. Or just, you know, regularly mulch them with a good composted material, and that'll give them a little slow dose of nutrients
yeah.
throughout the year.
I've had great luck. My first hedge actually was an arborvitae that they were a foot tall when I got them.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're 15, 18 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a good answer.
Yeah.
Question for Miss Wishy, perhaps.
All right.
One made for you, the cook. I'm trying to wage a war against wild onions in my yard.
I guess she could cook them, huh?
Yeah, if I had lots of time, I would dig them up one by one. However, I don't have enough centuries left in my lifetime to do that. I promise I am not a proponent of chemical warfare against most of the natural world, but I'd like to know about my options as I combat these wild onions.
All right, Gene Alleman. Ironically enough, Gene, your name closely resembles that of onions, the allium. So there might be some kindred spirit there. I don't know. Wild onions are hard to control. And yeah, short of like hand digging them all, sometimes you do have to resort to use of pesticides. The one that works is a combination of 2,4-D, which is your standard broadleaf evergreen, yep, or broadleaf weed control, rather.
Right.
Dicamba. And then the active ingredient that you really want to look for in that cocktail, if you will, is triclopyr. And you remember Confront?
Yes.
That, you know, it's good against violets, that sort of thing. The triclopyr is sort of that kicker that adds the extra oomph that helps to control really hard to control weeds like violets and onions.
Now, are you talking buying two separate things? Is it one?
She needs to look at the active ingredients of any product. Don't be impressed by labels and names, but actually look at the active ingredients, and you want that combination of dicamba. Don't ever mix those chemicals on your own.
Okay.
Dicamba, 2,4-D, and triclopyr is the combination that you want in terms of being most effective. So,
all right.
And, you know, if it's labeled for onions, that sort of thing, it might have a sticky thing in it as well, the surfactant stuff. That helps it stick to the glossy foliage of the onions, so that can kind of expedite the process. And just, you know, mix it up and then hand, you know, don't broadcast spray, but spot treat the onions when they
come. It'll only take 5 years instead of 50.
Exactly.
It takes some time.
It does take some time.
If you have a question for Bob or Dr. Wishy, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, I have sharpened my pen for your Latin word of the week.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
Well, the Latin word of the week this week is planus, planum, or plana.
As in flat.
As in flat.
Sharps and flats. There's a song here.
Oh, there you go. But I was thinking of sort of flat against the wall, like my spoliate apple tree.
Then how come a planet isn't flat?
Because it's P-L-A-N-U-S.
Okay.
U-M or A, so it's probably the U in there. Because I have another Latin word of the week coming up in the next couple of weeks that you are going to be really surprised at what it means.
Oh, I hope so.
Because you would, when you look at it, you would think it meant something completely different than what it means.
I love those
kind
of words.
But I'll have to just keep you waiting on that. So planus, but you know when you plane something?
Oh, make plane. It flat, sure, there you go.
Yeah.
Plane.
Okay.
Or the western plains are flat.
There we go.
Sit corrected.
Come
here.
On.
Okay.
So planus, planum, plana, flat. For example, Juncus, planifolius.
The broadleaf rush.
So planifolius, flat foliage, flat foliage.
Flat foliage. Yep.
Broadleaf. So often what we see is the planus suggests broad and flat.
Okay.
Right? Cypripedium plana petalum.
Whoa.
Petalum, petals.
Petalum, yeah.
So flat petals, monarch, lady slipper.
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
Okay. Vanilla planifolia.
One of my favorite ice creams.
Vanilla.
Yeah.
And, like, think about the vanilla bean.
Flat.
Flat.
That's it.
Salix planifolia.
The diamond leaf willow.
Broad. Well, most leaves are flat.
Yeah.
You can argue that, right? But it's a very broad diamond leaf willow. Salix planifolia. Xanthoxylum planispinum.
I just saw this last week. The bamboo leaf prickly ash.
Did you really?
No.
Xanthoxylum planispinum. What's planispinum? Spinum.
It'd be a flat spine.
Prickly spine.
Okay, prickly
yeah,
spine.
Prickles, yeah, prickles, you know, yeah, like spiny. So flat spine.
That's it.
Flat prickles. How about that?
I'm working on that myself.
All right, so if you see planus, planum, or plana, it might be attached to foliace, petalum, or spinum, you'll know that something about that plant is broad and flat.
Broad and flat.
Broad and flat. All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to highlight some of the All-America Rose selections this year, also the Perennial Plant of the Year, and some fabulous native azaleas.
Homegrown is produced by the never edgy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.